fine briefs and a very fine oral argument today. The court appreciates it. The case is taken under advisement.
Something in mind is a contract?
Yes. Our next case for oral argument today is number 042574, Brian Daniels against Alan Uchtman. Mr. Hansen.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Hansen, and I represent the appellant in this case, Brian Daniels, who has been incarcerated by the state of Illinois since 1982. Mr. Daniels' habeas application in this case focuses on claims involving newly discovered evidence. Evidence that Mr. Daniels could not have discovered during his trial or during his direct appeal. And that is a key distinction in this case because under the AEDPA, Mr. Daniels could not have discovered those newly discovered evidence claims until he received a state court adjudication which was contrary to clearly established federal law or unreasonable in light of the facts presented. That did not happen in this case until February 5th, 2003, and Mr. Daniels filed his habeas application within 1 year of that date. The district court correctly recognized that this court has not addressed the issue before this court today under 2244D1D. Nevertheless, the district court dismissed the petition in this case, the habeas petition in this case, based on this court's ruling in Owens v. Boyd. This court's decision in Owens v. Boyd, however, is entirely consistent with Daniels' interpretation of the AEDPA. In Owens, this court made very clear that the petitioner's claims in that case were not based on newly discovered evidence, but rather could have been brought within the time established or allowed under Section 2244D1A. That is a key distinction in Owens because the facts of Owens would have been decided the same way under the interpretation of the AEDPA, which Mr. Daniels advocates in this case. That is because in Owens, the factual predicate of his claims could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence by the time that that statute ran under Section 2244D1A. But that simply is not so in Mr. Daniels' case because his application focuses on truly newly discovered evidence. The real argument in Owens that the petitioner advanced was that the statute of limitations under Section 2244 was a subjective one, that the statute of limitations did not begin to run under 2244D1D until that petitioner understood the legal significance of his factual predicate. Mr. Daniels does not make a similar argument in this case. His position is entirely consistent with the holding in Owens that the statutory trigger for the statute of limitations under Section 2244 is objective. In this case, it was when he obtained a state court adjudication that was unreasonable in light of the facts presented in his case. So Owens actually squares with Daniel's position and interpretation of Section 2244. The AEDPA statutory scheme mandates that significant deference is given to state court decisions. And that fact really illustrates what we believe is a fundamental flaw in the position advanced by the respondent and adopted by the district court below. And that is, in a case such as this, a a petitioner could have his federal habeas claims time barred before the time that he even brings his state habeas claims. In Mr. Daniels' case, he had 2 years to file his claim under the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure. That was his statutory right, and clearly under the AEDPA, it was in his best interest to take the maximum time necessary to formulate his best and put forward his best case in the state court, because under the AEDPA, significant deference is granted to a state court decision. That's not an insurmountable hurdle once you get a state court decision, but it is a significant hurdle that a federal habeas petitioner has to overcome once they are faced with a state court decision. So Mr. Daniels, in this case, had 2 years in which to bring his claims in state court. Under the position adopted by the district court, Mr. Daniels could have known of the factual predicate underlying his claims, and his federal habeas cause of action would be time barred before the time that he even brang his claim in state court, which leads to a situation where a person in state custody is faced with two situations, neither of which is good. Either they rush to file their state court decision, their state court habeas, their state petition under state habeas or post-conviction, in order to secure their federal time for federal habeas relief after that state court decision. But that's not desirable because it encourages state court petitioners to rush beyond which the time that they are statutory allowed, in which case they may be stuck with a bad state court decision, which will receive deference in the federal courts. Now, the other thing that a state petitioner could do is file a premature federal habeas claim in order to toll his federal statute of limitations for his habeas claims. But the Supreme Court recently in Carey v. Saffold warned against that very situation, where it warned against interpretations of the AEDPA which lead to the filing of non-exhausted federal claims prior to the time that they have been fully briefed and exhausted in state court. The AEDPA gives deference to state court decisions. It is entirely consistent with the statutory scheme under the AEDPA that it also would give deference to the state court's decision for the statute of limitations in the newly discovered evidence context. But even if Mr. Daniels' position under Section 2244D1D is not correct, and this court were to adopt the interpretation advanced by the district court and the respondent on appeal, Mr. Daniels' application is still timely because of his Brady claim. At the time he discovered or reasonably could have discovered the facts underlying his Brady claim, he already had a state post-conviction petition pending. Therefore, under Section 2244D, it would be told under the state's interpretation of the AEDPA, and his application would be timely. Now, the state's argument is that Mr. Daniel could have discovered his Brady claim earlier than it did with the exercise of due diligence. And I would like to direct the court to its opinion in Moore v. Knight, which the respondent cited as the standard for due diligence in this case. Moore involved alleged improper ex parte communication between a judge and jury. And prior to sentencing, the judge informed the attorneys and the petitioner of the alleged communication, but did not disclose the extent of it. Now, 5 years later, the petitioner in that case learned of a suspicion that the judge may have engaged in more improper context. The court held The court held, though, that at that point he did not know any specific information about what transpired between the judge and jurors. He could only speculate. And the facts in that case track really what happened here in this case to a T, where even if you accept that Kasten Rollins' affidavit in June of 1999 placed Mr. Daniels on notice that he should have theorized about a potential Brady claim, it wasn't enough. It does not require maximum feasible diligence. Just as in the Moore case, Mr. Daniels hired an investigator. Mr. Daniels was imprisoned at the time, which the Moore court held is taken into account in determining a due diligence analysis under 2244. And after he discovered the facts, non-speculative facts supporting his Brady claim, he brought that claim. But at the time that he discovered those facts, a state court petition was already pending. So I would advance that even under the state's interpretation or the district court's interpretation, Mr. Daniels' claims are timely.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. We'll hear now from Mr. Iskowich.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Hansen, may it please the court. My name is David Iskowich, and I'm with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. Your Honors, we don't disagree that this habeas petition entails claims which are based on newly discovered evidence. We also don't agree with the petitioner's assertion that he needed to properly exhaust his state court remedies in order to come to federal court in the proper fashion. We do disagree with, however, is the petitioner's reading of the statute, which we invoked in the district court and which the district court agreed with, Section 2244D1D. The language of Section 2244D1D states that the date on which the one-year statute of limitations runs begins on the date on which the factual predicate of the claim or claims presented in the habeas petition could have been discovered by exercising due diligence. The problem we have with petitioner's approach is that it ignores the statutory language and it ignores this court's, or at least misreads this court's decision in Owens versus Boyd. The petitioner has characterized facts as the facts underlying his claims in this case as the state Supreme Court's denial of his petition for leave to appeal on post-conviction review. He says that this is the proper date by which to start 2244D1D because before this point, his claims, quote, did not exist. And this is in his reply brief at page 14. This is not true. It's not the case. His claims did exist, and in any event, Section D1D doesn't speak about the discovery of claims, but the discovery of the factual predicate or factual basis upon which those claims first introduced in state court and later, following exhaustion, introduced in federal court are based. The factual basis here is an affidavit executed by one Kasten Rollins, who was the state's primary witness at the petitioner's trial back in 1984. Within this affidavit lie the factual bases or factual predicates upon which the petitioner based his claims in his state collateral attack, which started out as a 214-01 attack, which is based on new evidence, and was later merged into a general post-conviction petition.
How did that affidavit, the execution of that affidavit, come about?
According to Mr. Rollins, he was approached in the early part of 1999 by representatives from petitioner. Those are unidentified representatives who asked him to provide some help in a future or anticipated state collateral attack. We don't know the exact date that he was approached, but we do know that it was in the first half of 1999 because he states in his affidavit that he was approached earlier this year, i.e. 1999, by representatives from the petitioner. In the affidavit, he claims that his testimony at trial...
Were these counsel for the petitioner?
It's not clear from the record, Your Honor. I don't know the specific counsel, but I do know that the firm which currently represents the petitioner did assist him in his state post-conviction efforts.
So your claim is that from the time, or what is your claim, from the time that the affidavit was executed?
At the very latest, Your Honor. And just by going with statutory language, this June 25th of 1999 is the objective date. It's the latest date. We gave him the latest date on which a reasonably diligent person could have discovered the factual basis for his future claims. This date very well could have been earlier in 1999. I think that might be what Your Honor's getting at. But it still would be untimely given an earlier date. Giving him the June 25th, 1990 date, which is the most reasonably objective date to give him, still results in an untimely petition under the subsection. The other problem with the petitioner's reading of the statute has to do with the language, quote, could have been discovered. The First Circuit in the United States versus Brackett explained that it would be an odd usage of the word discovered to refer to the discovery of a state court decision as a factual basis or factual predicate under D1D. We submit that that is the correct interpretation. It's the correct holding, and this court should follow it accordingly. With respect to the Brady claim, the petitioner contends in an alternative argument that even if we are correct and that D1D does dispose of the petition based upon that June 25th affidavit, he contends that the Brady claim is still timely because the facts related to the Brady claim weren't developed or discovered until a representative from my opponent's firm sat down with Mr. Rollins, and he explained to them that there was indeed a pending charge at the time that he testified at the defendant's trial. This charge was for breaking and entering Mr. Rollins was a juvenile at that time. The problem with this, again, I go back to the text of the statute. When a reasonably diligent person exercising due diligence could have discovered the factual basis for the claim is the time at which the statute begins to run. In his affidavit, Mr. Rollins avers that he was not only pressured at the time of the investigation in early 1982 to provide false information to authorities, but he was also coerced and pressured at the time of trial to testify as he did. A reasonably diligent person in petitioner's position who's been incarcerated for over 20 years certainly could have simply asked, why did you feel pressured to testify as you did? The answer to that, as we know, allegedly, from Mr. Rollins' later contacts with the firm, is that certain individuals from the state's attorney's office allegedly offered to, quote, help him out with his pending minor charge as a juvenile. This question could have been asked very easily, very simply. The district court aptly held that there's no sign in this record that Mr. Rollins, quote, stonewalled Mr. Daniels, was difficult to deal with, was unwilling to assist, and in fact, Mr. Rollins in his affidavit himself says that he was ready to come forward and tell authorities and tell the petitioner and tell the courts what, according to him, really happened at the time of the offense. The statute's very clear. The circuits in the United States, the 1st, the 5th, the 8th, the 9th, I'm sorry, the 9th, the 10th, and 11th, have all held, as we espouse here, that the factual basis for a claim begins when they could have been discovered by due diligence, not when the last state court to adjudicate a claim renders its decision. This is the prudent holding, and it's one that should be followed by this court. And we respectfully request that it do so and affirm the district court's denial on the basis of untimeliness. If there are no further questions, it's been my pleasure, Your Honors. Thank you,
Mr. Skwitch. Your time had expired, sir. Therefore, the case will be taken under advisement with the court's thanks to both counsel for their fine briefs.